concept of hyper-religiosity in neuropsychiatric illnesses. Excuse me for I'm being out of breath. We had a council meeting and they kept on longer than I thought they would. So let's welcome Dr. Woodcock to our talk.
I don't know, do we want to close the door? There's another session next door.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. I would like today to examine several aspects of psychological description in general as they relate to descriptions of religiosity in particular. I would like to think about the distinction between the concepts of health or physiologic function and illness or pathologic function, how we make this distinction, and how our understanding of illness or pathology sometimes illuminates our understanding of health or physiology. I will illustrate this paradigm first in a very brief overview of psychological descriptions of religiosity, and then in reference to neurological descriptions of brain function. I would then like to look at religiosity in the neuropsychiatric disorder of temporal lobe epilepsy, in which these psychological and neurological approaches may be combined. This will allow us to consider a possible model of how the brain mediates higher level emotional experience, particularly meaning and religiosity. Finally, I would like to consider some of the implications of these issues for our notion of humanness. The study of religious behavior has been problematic in the psychosocial sciences. Much of the attention given religious behavior in the early 20th century emphasized the extremes or the clearly pathological associations of religiosity. William James offered his Varieties of Religious Experience in 1902. Walters summarizes James's approach. James had no interest in differentiating between normal and pathologic in religious expression. In the process of cooking down religious experience to determine its essential components, he made no effort to screen out the atypical and bizarre, to eliminate the influence of psychopathology upon the final result. Instead, he took as his major premise, if there were such a thing as inspiration from a higher realm, it might well be that the neurotic temperament would furnish the chief condition of the requisite receptivity. We learn most about a thing when we view it in its most exaggerated form. This is as true of religious phenomena as any other kind of fact. The essence of religious experience, he insisted, is most prominent in those which are most one-sided, exaggerated, and intense. Walter states that James begged the question of reliable reporting by enunciating the premise that psychopathology enhances capacity for religious insight and interpretive authority. Pratt challenged this association, stating that the great majority of those possessing dissociated mind states have none of the superiorities set forth by James. The highest type of man, in the religious life as elsewhere, is the unified and rational self. Here we find Pratt drawing a distinction between health and illness, which James didn't find convenient or necessary. I'm not sure that any of us can offer a prima facie defense for Pratt's choosing the unified and rational self over James's predilection for the neurotic and the exaggerated. But thinking about the distinction and the reasons for our choice is essential if we are to develop any notion of what people are either meant to be or can become. Freud's prolonged interest in religious behavior and its psychological foundations seemed to increase as he grew older. His biases were clear from the outset, however, as his theoretical speculations about religious behavior were grounded in his study of pathological associations rather than any empirical survey. Freud emphasized especially the neurotic origins of narcissism and obsessionalism in religious behavior. He wrote in 1907, "One might venture to regard the obsessional neurosis as a pathological counterpart to the formation of a religion. To describe this neurosis as a private religious system and religion as a universal obsessional neurosis." In 1928, he wrote in The Future of an Illusion, "The true believer is in a high degree protected against the danger of certain neurotic afflictions. By accepting the universal neurosis, he is spared the task of forming a personal neurosis." More recent empirical studies have attempted to consider the effect of religiosity on certain issues. By implication, they address the distinction between religious health or illness. These studies have considered the relationship between religiosity and anxiety, authoritarianism, youthful deviance, adolescent drinking, development of gender identity and sexual behavior, effects on the risk of suicide, attitudes about illness, particularly terminal illness, death anxiety, and even public opinion about legal responsibility for mentally retarded felons. I think that while these approaches may be more empirical, in each case they raise at least an implied distinction between health and illness, although in nearly every case, from authoritarianism to gender identity to attitudes about terminal illness and suicide, the criteria for the healthy alternative is highly subjective and indeed the subject of debate in society and professional organizations. In spite of these difficulties, examination of pathological conditions has long been an intriguing, albeit beclouded, window on physiologic function. This is demonstrated in the historical development of clinical medicine, particularly in neurology. The famous case of Phineas Gage provided a major impetus to understand normal brain function on the basis of its alteration by pathologic processes. Mr. Gage underwent an inadvertent frontal lobotomy when the tamping iron he was setting for blasting in Cavendish, Vermont, tore through his brain in 1848. One of his physicians, John Harlow, carefully chronicled his transformation from a hard-working, reverent, sober family man to a slovenly, disinhibited drunkard following the accident. Subsequently, the French and British schools of neurology developed the method of clinical pathologic anatomic correlation, illuminating the relationship of the frontal lobe in motivation and organization of behavior and motor control, and the temporal lobe for language function. The neurologic method of diagnosis is based in large measure on knowledge of brain function garnered in this way. Information concerning alterations in neurologic function gathered through history and physical examination combine with knowledge of functional neuroanatomy to allow localization of the pathology within the nervous system. Specific pathophysiologic mechanisms, such as infection, hemorrhage, or ischemia, can then be considered in keeping with the associated features of the disease process and knowledge of the natural history of diseases afflicting the nervous system. This approach to understanding the function of particular anatomic areas of the brain is not without its difficulties. Often brain disease is less well localized than is immediately apparent. In addition, it is not obvious whether the affected region is exhibiting a loss of primary function or is disinhibiting function of another area. Nonetheless, the physiologic status of the focus of the neurologist's interest is not generally in question. That nervous system function, such as diurnal sleep-wake cycles, consciousness, sensory experience, motor control, and language capacity are physiologic rather than pathologic is accepted without question. As we have noted, this distinction is much less clear when the psychologist focuses on the higher order functions of the nervous system. without an overarching conceptual framework encompassing the fundamental philosophic issues of epistemology, ontology, and ethics, the investigator of psychologic function is left without ready criteria in differentiating the physiologic from the pathologic, especially in regard to the individual's exercise of free will, the development and exercise of conscience, and the search for and attribution of meaning and values in life. This difficulty is particularly acute in any investigation of religion, where these psychological and philosophical issues commingle without clear line of demarcation. To summarize to this point, I have tried to demonstrate that much of the modern psychology of religiosity is based on an assessment of pathology. Such data provide little direct basis for a normative model, unless one has begged the question by starting with the conclusion that all religiosity is pathologic. By way of comparison, however, in the more medical model of neurology, it has been possible to make more sense of physiology on the basis of an examination of pathologic states, in large measure precisely because there is much clearer agreement about the differences between the physiologic and pathologic states. I would like now to attempt to bridge this conceptual gap between psychologic and neurologic methodology by considering the neuropsychiatric illness, temporal lobe epilepsy, as a model of emotionality in general and religiosity in particular, which combines relevant psychological descriptors with a substantial body of information on pathologic brain functioning. This model has been proposed to explain the question of how higher level emotional experiences might be mediated by the brain. An association between epilepsy and psychosis has long been noted, dating back to antiquity. More recent studies have demonstrated that when psychosis occurs in epilepsy, it is usually focal rather than generalized epilepsy, and the epileptic focus is usually to be found in the left temporal lobe. Other clinical manifestations of temporal lobe seizures may mimic or distort a variety of emotional states and expressions. These include anxiety, fear, irritability, dissociative states including fugue and multiple personality, affective states such as euphoria, mania, and depression, and rarely aggressive states. It is apparent that such a wide variety of emotional states might make the differentiation of temporal lobe epilepsy from other organic and functional psychiatric pathology difficult. Furthermore, some of these emotional states are important physiologically as well, such as anxiety, fear, and even euphoria. In spite of the fact that the demarcation between the physiologic expression of such states and their pathologic disruption is sometimes difficult on both conceptual and clinical grounds, it is possible to view emotionality and religiosity here in association with an identifiable pathologic state. The expression of emotional pathology in temporal lobe epilepsy, however, is not limited to the seizure or ictal state. A variety of changes in emotionality are also seen in the period between identifiable seizures, the interictal phase. In the 19th century, these changes were identified as the epileptic personality. As the pathophysiologic mechanisms and pharmacologic management of epilepsy began to be better understood in the second third of this century, and as the psychosocial contribution to the etiology of emotional illness became better appreciated, the existence of the epileptic personality was called into question. In the past decade, there has been a resurgence of clinical study of this question. A number of investigators have found a constellation of personality changes to be more prominent in epileptic patients. There remains disagreement as to whether these changes are more prominent in temporal lobe epilepsy as compared to epilepsy of generalized etiology, or focal epilepsy arising from foci and other anatomic areas. At least part of this difficulty is based on the technical limitations in localizing the origin of epileptic activity in human subjects, the tendency of localized epilepsy to spread to other contiguous and contralateral areas of the brain, and the occurrence of multiple epileptic foci. The specific nature of these personality changes and the speculation regarding them regarding their pathophysiology are of particular interest in regard to an understanding of religiosity. The characteristics usually cited include a heightened philosophical interest, a sense of personal destiny, sober humorlessness, obsessionalism, circumstantiality, hypermoralism, hypergraphia, altered sexuality, usually decreased interest in sexuality, and a personality characteristic referred to as viscosity or stickiness, an inability of the patient to let go of certain ideas or personal encounters. For instance, viscosity may be demonstrated by a patient whose history goes on and on because he or she finds significance in seemingly every thought and detail of their lives. Furthermore, they seem to have great difficulty in finally ending the interview and leaving the office. When they finally do, often after considerable effort on the part of the clinician, they are as likely as not to be knocking on the door 30 seconds later to tell you one last thing they thought might be important. I think that you can see that one characteristic of many of these features that they might have in common is the association with the notion of emotional significance or meaning. It is as if everything in the life of such a person has become emotionally important and meaningful. Unfortunately, at the same time, a sense of priorities of significance is lost. The otherwise trivial is imbued with the same significance as the otherwise important, resulting in a pedantic, obsessional humorlessness. The defect appears to be one of a pathological, indiscriminate attachment of meaning to one's thoughts and the events of one's life. When one considers the cultural role of philosophy and religion as addressing issues of ultimate meaning in life, it is not surprising that many of these patients exhibit increased interest in these areas, depending on their social and cultural background. The pathophysiology of temporal lobe epilepsy provides a basis for conjecture regarding the mechanism of these emotional changes in this condition. Blumer, Baer, and Geschwind have been proponents of a mechanism referred to as limbic or temporal hyperconnection. They speculate that in temporal lobe epilepsy, the connectivity between the temporal lobe and closely related limbic structures is enhanced, in part due to the capability of temporal cortex to kindle or become more susceptible to neuronal firing in the presence of the spontaneous intermittent electrical discharge of seizures. Because of the importance of medial temporal and limbic structures in mediating emotional experience, there is then an enhancement of emotional expression in general and a permeation of cognitive experience with emotional significance. It is not my goal here to provide a critique of this model, but rather to point out that the brain remains the structural counterpart to emotional and religious experience. As we learn more about the brain's function, we will understand better the physical mechanisms mediating what we refer to as mind. As this progression continues and brain function in regard to emotional and cognitive experience, what we call mind, is further elaborated, it will be increasingly important that we differentiate the distinctive nature of the objective physical processes of the brain and the always subjective experience of the mind. We must insist that the nature of the mind, beginning with consciousness and encompassing awareness, self-awareness, choice, and ultimately conscience, and the search for values and meanings, is fundamentally different from the nature of the physical properties of the brain. We must recognize reductionistic attempts to equate the existence and content of the mind with the physical material and processes of the brain to be only equivocations, and maintain the inherent distinctions between these categories. For instance, Winnicott speaks of his psychocentric notion of illusion. Quote, man's capacity to transform reality into something permeated with inner significance. Man cannot do without illusion, he says, since it gives meaning and sustenance to his experience of himself. Winnicott hopes, of course, to avoid having to ask why man should find a need for meaning in his experience of himself in the first place. As Sperry, who has become interested now in the what he calls Big Three, consciousness, free will, and values, gives these the euphemism emergent, trying to maintain an essential connection between them and the physical brain with which he, as a scientist, is so much more comfortable, and clearly at the same time avoiding any implication that these characteristics might have either an origin or a connection which is transcendent. It is simply not possible to explore the higher order functions of the human nervous system without recognizing the subjective nature of the object of study and therefore of the limitations of objective methods. Focus on objective or measurable parameters, however valid and useful, can neither remove the subjective nature of any psychological phenomena nor describe it fully. If we attempt to understand a subjective human experience only in objective terms, we have missed the point. While we must use propositional language to communicate sensibly about even subjective phenomena, we must not confuse such propositions with the reality of the subjective experience. Inherently subjective phenomena require subjective tools of investigation. The phenomenologic approach in psychology has become equated with the presumptive conclusion that not only what you see is what you get, but that it is also all you get. Any introspective or subjective data is unacceptable. As determinism does away with choice and therefore conscience, materialism does away with consciousness and therefore the mind. Hence, the most precious human attributes, by virtue of their subjectivity, become lost to the detail of the material of human existence. The intellectually healthy skepticism of the modern era has combined with a lack of recognition of the inherent limitations of science to produce a widespread cynicism regarding all higher order human experience and to call into question the historical divine ontologic object of religious language and concern. In explaining and helping to clarify these issues in the future, we have the opportunity of maintaining the highest level of respect and wonder for the creation we call human. The highest and most essential human qualities, though recently belittled and even maligned, we know from our own experience will always be imbued with a significance so marvelous we continue to be left in awe of them and do not hesitate to acknowledge even their transcendence. Thank you.
Any questions? We have a couple of 3 minutes here, so.
Yes. Yes. Well, I think the question is...
Could you summarize that for the benefit of the paper?
I think that the point is that for someone who has difficulty clarifying meaning, an external formulation of meaning might be very helpful. Well, that's often very true. But I think the question that we're really posed with is not whether or not outside formulations of meaning can be helpful to us, but where the search for meaning comes from. Is that something that's imposed externally, or is that something that's fundamental to our own existence? Is that something, if it is fundamental to our own existence, is pathologic and should be jettisoned, or is physiologic and should be developed and cultivated? Well, that can involve a variety of manifestations. The way that I've developed the concept here, I've tried to draw this, to show the similarities between the specific hyper-religious behavior and the hyper-emotional, hyper-philosophic behavior in general, which seems to be associated with this excessive attribution of meaning to everything in life. Well, that's another course. We just can't get into that.
No. But I mean, is the most common temporal lobe, is that the most, does it just spontaneously arise in a person? Or, you see, I have friends who have had accidents and because of it, you know, falling on their head when they were in a chair or going through a window on his bicycle.
Most people who exhibit the particular syndrome that has been described have a very circumscribed form of epilepsy when it's looked at in terms of both brain function electrophysiologically and the injury itself. Yeah, they don't have either generalized epilepsy, idiopathic epilepsy, or secondarily generalized epilepsy. So this is a relatively, the point is not that everybody who has epilepsy has this syndrome. The point is that this, the syndrome has been identified and that at least some people do. And as many well-described specific syndromes can sometimes be helpful to us in understanding something specifically about how the brain works, that's the case here.
We got to stop at this point. Where are you from, Jonathan? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm in Boston, and I've trained in neurology and psychiatry and continue to practice both and run an inpatient evaluation and treatment service in the overlap area at McLean Hospital in Belmont.
Great. Thank you.